And hello once again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're also on the web at www.kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guest is Ron Carlson. Ron teaches creative writing at Arizona State University and lives in Scottsdale. His stories have been much anthologized and have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, Playboy, Gentleman's Quarterly, Plowshares, and other magazines. He is author of three novels and four collections of short stories. His current book, A Kind of Flying, just released by Norton, is a compilation of short stories from three of his collections. And he may not know this, but a fellow writer, Joanne Mapson, said yesterday, Ron is one of the three best short story writers in this country today. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you, Barbara? Which country?
I think this one.
Yeah, okay.
Whichever one we're in.
Great.
This collection is just, it's wonderful having all these stories from those other books in one. How did this come about?
Well, it's I'll tell you why that's wonderful. It's wonderful for me so that I stopped leaving the house at the last minute with the wrong folder. And so now some of these stories have been out of print for a while. You know how books, each of these three books, The News of the World, Plan B for the Middle Class, and then The Hotel Eden, had really fun careers, but short. They got, all three were selected by the LA Times as a book of the year, etc. But they didn't, you know, Plan B's been out of print for 5 or 6 years. And so to have these stories back is just wonderful for me.
Yeah. Now, all of the stories from the other collections were not included. Did you have to choose a certain number from each?
Well, we chose, yeah. When I first started writing stories, and I was actually supposed to, I was in Salt Lake City a long time ago. It's my hometown, and I was supposed to be writing a novel, and I was just taking these holidays off. All these things, you know, I just had kids. My life was kept diverting me. I mean, I was writing a novel, but whether or not these people would get back together was kind of beside the point. I mean, I didn't even care anymore because I had kids. So I was writing these stories, and my editor at Norton, my longtime editor, she's the editor for this book, I've known her for over 25 years, is Carol Huck Smith, and she called and said, I think we have a book here. And it was really, I thought, huh, you could have a book of stories. And so we had plenty of stories, and with each of the books, I worked from about 17 or 18, and then we included 12 or 13. My method in that, especially in this last book I did with Picador called At the Jim Bridger, you cut one story. There's one good story that doesn't get on the bus, and he has to wait or she has to wait till the next collection. So when we did the book, Carol and I, I had several friends who said, I'll do it. You know, I should have let them because I was trying to be a little strict, and then I'd cut out stories, and Carol would put them back in, and we had a roundabout way. She tests stories out. Whenever she flies, she hands a story to her seatmate and says, what do you think? And that's led to a lot of the stories being included. So it's been, I'm very pleased with it. I think that there are two or three stories from each book that are not in here, and maybe that'll send people back to the, you can find the books, you know, all my old books on the internet anymore, so it's
sure
like that.
And I have actually found some in bookstores around,
yeah.
And
yeah.
It's wonderful when I find one, even though I already have copies. I'm just hoarding at this point and handing them out, you know.
That's nice.
Some of the stories in here, I mean, the Governor's Ball, the first story in the book,
yeah,
was an incredible story. I want to hear about this. I know in your introduction you talked about, or your prologue or your foreword or whatever it's called in this book.
It's my little letter.
Your letter, your Friends of My Youth letter. You talk about how certain stories came to you, and you did mention this one about driving a mattress to the dump. But
right.
But I want to know more. I mean, you end up having these homeless people,
oh,
people who seem like homeless people, picking them up, and they one of them has an epiphany as the character's driving her and her guy around a park or around on the street. And will you talk about this story?
Well, the Governor's Ball was a watershed moment for me as a writer because, like all writers, I mean, I was teaching myself how to do it, stumbling around. I wrote a novel. These things are people always. There's a lot of talk about writing as if, you know, I was polishing my stroke, but when in fact what I was trying to do is not drown and you sputter and come up on the other side of your story just happy to be high and dry. And when I was writing The Governor's Ball, I started with that very real thing of it's still a long-standing joke in our family now all these many years that every time we see somebody hauling a mattress in a truck, we see mattresses on the freeway, too. especially at term time when people all change apartments. But on the way to the dump one time in Salt Lake City, I was fixing up an old house, trying to get it rented, and it was cold, and I mishandled this load, and this mattress got away on the freeway, and it actually, the truth is, I mean, the seed of the story is that the mattress flew off the elevated freeway, and so I'm admitting here that I did drop a mattress about four stories, and it was an accident, and I'm good with trucks, and I want everybody to know that I'm not careless in this regard. It happened once. It's not happening to me anymore. So what happens is that I kept that around a long time. An incident is not a story, and an incident could be the motor for a story if you write it carefully. You go in, and so when I went in to this incident, I'm very interested in how the narrator is not me, and there are times, and I'll just say this now, that I don't know that when I start. I don't make an outline and say, "And these are the seven ways he's not like me. He's good with money. He plays the piano. He's left-handed." I don't know that. I mean, I don't know how he treats his friends or where he's been yesterday. So, and I use the draft to try to find that out, and it's necessary to find that out so that you can understand the value of what's about to happen. Or at the end of when the draft is completed. So you write a sentence at a time. You write it as closely as you can. It needs to be solid enough for you to stand on so you can have a place from which to write the next sentence. And that's why I use a lot of real places in my stories, at least in the drafts, because it helps me believe that it could have occurred. And the only person who needs to believe your story is you while you're writing it. As soon as you say the four men sat in the room playing cards, you know, the next sentence for me would be, "No, there's no men and no room, and I made up the cards too." So I'm looking for something that I can carry on, and so I worked very, very closely to the end of the episode that I was writing about the night and the mattress, and then I came to that sentence where it says, he sees the two people in the night. It's cold, and they're drinking. They're over against a blue post office van, drinking out of paper bags, and he drives up to them. And when you drive up to people in a story or someone intrudes, and many times there are intruders in stories, people who come into the story from somewhere, you have to sit in all the chairs. And I remember the day writing The Governor's Ball when he's interviewing the two people, and the first thing he said, it was so interesting to me, because he said, "Have you seen a mattress?" Yeah. I've never said that to anybody in real life. I haven't had the chance, and then you follow. So then you start to make it up. You trust it, you follow, and then about halfway down that page, one of the man who's out in the night says, "Would this king-size posturpedic fly out of the sky?" And it's... for me, Barbara, it was this moment when I thought, "Oh my God, he saw it." I mean, I'd love to see a mattress fly out of it. I mean, I don't wish anybody harm, but God, would that be great? And I thought he got to see it, and then I thought, "Oh, there's something going on here. I'm doing." So what I've used that, and I wrote that story a long time ago. I wrote that story 20 years ago, January, and it taught me to stay close. And when you're in a story, especially when you're dealing with people you're not certain of, or you've just come to meet because they stepped up into your story, It's very important to go slow and to what I call sit in their chair. I mean, the most undervalued craft device that fiction writers need is empathy. I mean, you need to be able to actually go around the table and imagine what it might be. And then, because for me, it's been the way that all these other doors have opened in the stories.
Yeah.
And I found other things.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here today with Ron Carlson, author of A Kind of Flying, selected stories just out by Norton. Back to the Governor's Ball. I thought The Mattress was just wonderful, too, because it was so symbolic to me. It was so symbolic of he has to go back to get it. He'd rather go back and get the mattress than go to the Governor's Ball because...
Yeah.
It seems that his relationship is coming apart, and the mattress was his mattress with his wife when they were first married.
Well, that's, you see, thank you. But that's the reader. That's so smart. But the reader comes along later, and I tried to get into that guy as closely as I could. I knew he was in some kind of bad faith. Over the years, as the Governor's Ball comes up, it strikes me that I still don't fully... I mean, there's some disconnect, as we say now, going on, and when he makes that decision to go get the mattress, I was surprised. He has a mission. He's supposed to be somewhere else. And of course, the best stories have two clocks. I mean, there's the clock, the motor of the current story, which is ticking. But then there's another clock, the inner clock that creates the dynamic. The inner and the outer story work, and so that a reader can come along and they'll always. They'll find your theme. It's not important. You know, that's a word that, as a creative writer or a fiction writer, I don't really use. It comes up in class sometimes where, as readers, if you see a motif in a story, you can touch it up. But usually if you see it, if you see, like, infidelity or honesty or the love of art, then it's already been polished enough. You don't need to go back and push something that's already going your way.
Hmm. So what do you begin with typically? I know you've told me, you know, a few things. You sometimes begin with a first line. You'll begin with this or that. But is there anything you can look at in your stories and say, this is how they usually come about? Somebody said something. I saw something.
Well, it has to be. There is a connection that's made. I mean, it's never academic. It never says, oh, I think that would be a good story. Or that's an arrest. I mean... That's an idea. It has to. There has to be a connection, and I was going to use that word in another context, but it has to be arresting. So there's some kind of a connection. It has valence for me, and I think that's the thing. Certainly that's not teachable, the things that the occurrences that and all the experiences people have. The last story I completed, I usually write from event. And it's a small event, but it has my attention. And it's sometimes an awkward event. It usually is because it has to get into my vision. I mean, like everybody else, I'm walking around in a fog most of the time. And but I mean, I'm not saying anything about everybody else. It's just me. But the thing is that sometimes it's something unusual. Like that story I wrote called Rocket Day, which is not in this book, but it was in Harper's either last year or this year. I forget, but. That story started with, you know, the fact that I was over at the high school one morning watching my son's physics class launch their rockets. They'd made these water-powered rockets, and I had run over early. I'd forgotten, so I wasn't properly dressed. My shirt was hanging out, and my hair was sticking up, and I had my binoculars across the front of my old Ford, and I was looking at the kids over on the football field, and I heard the wheels of the gravel popping and the wheels of the golf cart of the security guard. As he came up and said, could he help me? And I had that feeling right then. I mean, it was absolutely like a little buzz in the back or a chill. Mm-hmm. I thought, uh-oh. And then you feel like you're beside yourself, and you watch yourself. The security guard comes up. He doesn't want some geezer glassing the co-eds on the football field. And you don't exactly want to be there either. And what would the story be? Well, there's only one way. There's only one way to find out. And I mean, so I would go in. I mean, I never know... totally where a story's going, but you go in and you start. I have to wait. I can't write that like the same day. I have to wait a month or 2 months. Sometimes it's a year. I'm about to write a story about the year I was 21, and my had a work study job at the University of Utah as a fry cook in the big medical center there on the hill, and my shift was 7 p.m. until 3 a.m. Friday and Saturday nights, and it was the year that I wrote Othello for the first time, and I saw my first dead body. I mean, one of the doctors said, "Do you want to go? You want to see a body? You want to see something?" And I don't know why, but I said, "You know," I said, "Yeah." And so I read Othello, saw a dead body, worked all night. It was greasy, greasier than I've ever been, just grease. And what will that story be?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know, but it's got me. I mean, I'm going to write it. I'll have to go in and find out.
Since we're talking about the governor's ball, sort of,
sure.
I want to ask you in relation to it, a line that you pulled out, which is a wonderful line, that line of, have you seen a mattress?
Right.
Now, dialogue is one of those things that I think can be especially elusive for new writers. And that line makes you want to lean in and stay with it and see what happens next. You know, nobody says that line very often, if ever.
Yeah. Well, you're hoping for, I don't see much bad dialogue. I mean, even in the undergraduate classes, most people are writing pretty well. The bad dialogue you see isn't the old clunky dialogue we used to see a long time ago, real wooden and kind of telling. But the bad dialogue you see now is a little blasé and a little television. I mean, I was watching television last week, and within like 35 minutes, I heard the line, "I can't believe you," whatever it was. And I thought, wow, I mean, that's tough. I mean, I don't know about that room of writers who wrote that sitcom, but they need to, you know, snap. They should put that on the wall. Anybody who says that should be fined. They could have a big party at the end of the season. But so I see a lot of lazy dialogue, and of course, but functional. So what I try to do as a writer is I go very slow. I mean, they say dialogue is meant to advance the story. Well, it is if the story is the Da Vinci Code. But it isn't if it's one of my stories. The dialogue may advance the story, but it's going to have trouble since the characters don't know the story yet. And they've got to sit there and listen to each other to find it out. And I listen as hard as I can to them. And I try to let them speak to their ability. Not everybody knows or is capable of enunciating their current state. And so there's a larger lesson here, as you can sense. But, I mean, dialogue is not meant to be on topic. It's meant to be dramatic. It's meant to be personal. It comes from the source. It comes from the heart. And so that many times when you're writing dialogue, you're really writing the way people don't talk to each other,
yes.
The way we can't listen to each other, or the way we use words to kind of obtrude, to obscure and hide. Other times, I look at Rosella Brown's book, Before and After, sometimes, where the policeman comes to the door, and what he's got to say to the woman is, "Your son probably murdered his girlfriend." And what he says, well, he can't say that. That's not the first thing. I mean, I see that in stories. We've got some bad news, Doris. he says, he knows her, so he says, I think he says something like, "Something happened," or he says, "It's about Tim," or whatever the boy's name is. I mean, there's certain things that are possible given a certain situation. Not all situations are boiling. There are actually some situations where people are bona fide sincere. Not all interchanges are riddled with contemporary American sarcasm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a case by case, and it's related to this other issue of the text, of narrative text, where what we're looking for is someone that so obviously has thought about every word, the way that say Annie Proulx does, or Annie Dillard, just two writers who are real fresh. You know, I think Robert Stone does, and you never see these big clunky blocks of prose that the people use when they start to get painted in the corner. So I think dialogue is simply a matter of, for a writer, the challenge is to be awake in the scene, and also you've got to tolerate the fact that your characters may go beyond your, you know, you may want the girl to say, "Look, Sam, you can," she bundles up her apron, "you can take this job and shove it," you know, you just, because you want that line, because it happened to you, you're sick of this guy, you're writing a story to get revenge at the diner you worked at in the 11th grade, and, well, Revenge is as good a motive, I guess, as any to write a story, but unfortunately, if you have that dogmatic rush, you're going to miss what's in the what's potential to the scene. I'm always waiting for the moment when I get off track, because then all of a sudden I think, oh, this is good. Let's follow. Let's see what's over here. And so I listen hard. I listen hard, and I try to create. Of course, I mean the default format is to create idiosyncratic voices that because the people we know don't really speak in sound bites. I mean, especially if you know someone well, they kind of speak in that code to you. Some of my friends are professors because I'm one, and we're in our building right now, we're going through a phase. There's four or five people, and men and women, who call each other dude, which I think it's just, you know, we needed to get some of that too. So before it got away.
Well, you know, we're going to take a short break. We're at the half, so
okay, sweet.
So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. More Ron Carlson and A Kind of Flying when we get back here. And I hope you're still here. And that's that. And here is Ron back with us. Endings as well. You have just the most marvelous endings. Your stories just end just right. And things aren't necessarily tied up in a nice little bow. But they end, and you go, yeah, that's how that was supposed to end.
Huh.
All right, do you labor over these endings? Or
well,
is it just
know,
a natural thing?
I'm a little more comfortable talking about, like, character or dialogue or imagery or point of view or maybe openings out of context than endings, because I don't think there's anything more unique to the individual animal than the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about them a lot in terms of many writers in their first 10 stories feel that there is a form, there is a all the stuff they knew as readers that you're going to have a, you know, suddenly she realized like that and then come in for a landing. And so I don't know, I'm a little mystified by endings. I know what I have red flags that I look for. They're all the stuff I used in my early stories. Things like little moonlight on the last page or the sudden rainstorm. Anything to bring in the soundtrack so you can get out. But I just try to make it appropriate to the... as you know, I write in a range. Some of my stories are comic, and so you can do something different there, especially if you have a voice going, as opposed to... say a long story like Blazo, which ends with the man lying in the snow. That's probably one of my favorite endings. In fact, right now, for the purposes, it's my favorite ending of any of my stories, because it's without answering the mystery, it ends the story. I mean, he's gone out there and seen where the terrible mistake was made, and he's lying in the snow. I like very much a physical embodiment. At the end of the story, but it's difficult for me to speak generally.
That's interesting. Well, for instance, Max, the story Max, where,
oh, right.
I mean, that ends so perfectly, and
yeah.
I'm curious how that...
Well, in a story, a little piece like that, you're gathering, so you sit down, and a lot happens, and, you know, Max is the kind of story that I certainly wrote in a sitting, if a day or a sitting, and so... when you throw things up on page one, you're sure to catch them on page three or four. And that's a little more difficult to keep. You know, that's why when I start a story, I stay in it. I mean, sometimes I have written stories in a day, but most of my stories take me between 8 and, I would say, 8 and 25 sittings, depending on what I'm doing. You know, most of the time I'm working in the morning for an hour and a half or like that before I come over here and harangue my students. and so it's in a story like Max, it's a little bit like walking a tightrope, and you get it. It's one of the great joys, and lots of writers talk about this, but is that as other surprises you find. And when I wrote that story, Zandus II, about the baseball player, who had killed people with foul balls. It started out thinking, I thought, what is this going to be? And then it turned on me, and I realized I didn't know if I was going to write a kind of a tall tale, and it's not. And it that story ended with, that was the biggest surprise I got, that feeling that of his, he's finally acknowledged the full weight of his, of what he has, and whose fault it really is. And it was amazing to me. I mean, just so surprising. So again and again, I've been, I'll read you, I'll give you an example here in a minute, but when I wrote a story called Half-Life, I wrote a story called A Note on the Type, and I started it out as a premise. I was going to have a little fun with all my friends who are printers. I work around a bunch of people who come up with these posters they make and these poems they print on their presses, and they say, look at this, and you start to read it, and they say, no, don't read it, look at this E. And so I thought that was funny that they're so, you know, and I learned the various technical terms for the parts of letters. And so I started a story, and I just love that feeling of going in. You need to go until you can't touch the bottom anymore, till the thing starts to move around on you a little bit. And then you, at the end of that story, I was well in, and I had whatever it was, you know, 3,000 words, and all of a sudden, a woman enters the story. The guy's trying to steal a car, and he's in the back when the proper owner gets in and starts to drive away. And so he's in this car with this woman, and boy, that's when you really got to hold on. And the end of that story pleased me so much, as it took my little premise and made it a story. That all of a sudden I had actual feet underneath it, and it made sense. So that's what I'm kind of looking for.
Now, do you ever start working on a story, or you're in the middle of a story, and suddenly another story or another idea comes to you, in which you find perhaps a bit more appealing, and perhaps is pulling you, or do you stay focused? Are you not fickle in that way?
Well, I am careful in this way. I do make notes. For story ideas, because it feels, you can feel the voltage, and that isn't true of all things. I mean, like I said, I don't know how many ideas we get, but you feel the voltage, you better write it down, you better make your note about what it was. But you can't skip out. I mean, it's one thing to be writing a novel and take a week and write a story. I'm going to say, because it's kind of what I'm doing right now, okay. But you can't start just because it's tough. Usually what you're doing is you're skating away from what's tough here. I mean, writing's tough. Staying in the room every day, please. And so you've got to be hard-headed about it. And so that's what I am, is I'm hard-headed, because I don't want the current story that I'm working on to get away. And I'm going to get this draft. That story over there. Oh, that looks cute over there. I think I'll go. No, it's not. This is your work. Stay here.
Well, maybe as you just said, you know, working on a novel and then going to a story, maybe it is two different things. Maybe if you're working on two different types of projects, is it okay to take, you know, say you're working on fiction and nonfiction, and whatever is coming to you can't be in your novel. It has to be an essay. It has to be, you know, it has to be something else.
You can write on it. You can take it. You know, I love that. That's what I love about computers, is just open a file and go.
Right.
But you're asking, I mean, if you start that as a custom, you're asking to have, it sounds like, Barbara, maybe this is happening to you.
Oh, no, it's not about me.
I'll tell you, you don't want to end up with 40 great, shining, unfinished projects. You want to get that one sturdy piece of work done, then turn to the next. I mean, I'm just talking for myself, but I know lots of writers. I mean, everybody I know is writing well, and everybody I know is writing really good 2-3-4-page story, and then the fifth page gets tough, and there it is, and there's all, you know, that's why desks have drawers. But it's also, the you know, you can go around to everybody's house and find these glittering things. They're so bright, and they're like sparks, but you can't cook with them.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in having the thing made. And that's really the difference between, bright, talented people and writers who are sometimes bright and sometimes talented, but real stubborn.
What about talking about works in progress? Do you keep your lips sealed pretty much until it's done and you hand it to somebody to read?
Yeah, it's. I do. The energy. I mean, I think the energy is real. You got to be real careful with taking the lid off the pot. There, you just say, "Look at this. Look what I'm making." Now, even even with close friends. I mean, even with your wife, you've got to. I keep guard until I have enough that I'm safe, and then it's so tempting, especially when you have a couple of three, four good mornings in a row, and you go. Maybe you're in a group of people. You're having lunch. They're also working, and you could say something. There's a little silence right before coffee, and you better not. just keep it. Just fold your hands and say, "Well, how's it going, Ron?" And you say, "Well, I'm working. I worked this morning, and that's it. That's good. That's good. You know, you don't need to say what happened. But we can talk about these stories." Like I said, I'm very happy to talk about stories I wrote 20 years ago.
Right.
I think they're still operating, and stories I've written through the years, they're still very, very alive for me. But I don't want to, I want the story to be read. I want to finish it up, and then I want to read it, and then it can come out of my room.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Ron Carlson, author of A Kind of Flying, published by Norton. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And along those lines, Ron, what about, you ever work on a story and you're 10 pages in, 5 pages in, whatever, and you lose interest? How do you know when it's just simply not working, and how do you know when it's difficult, and that's why you feel like you're losing interest?
Well, I don't. I mean, I'm not going to lose interest. I'm just going to go and get it. It's...
So if you start it, you're going to go
after
it.
It's harder, Barbara, in longer works. Novels, I mean, everybody has a crisis of confidence with a novel. You think, this is a lot of work. Fitzgerald used to say he was writing stories about boys and girls that nobody cared about. And the whole, I mean, you have this in a novel, you say, well, this is a lot of work for my little story. But with, it's such an interesting thing. We're really talking about the writer's posture, or the writer in her life now, and I think that it's important to have faith in whatever way you can achieve it. You have to, the key is to, I mean, the first thing I write on the board of any group I teach is up above the blackboard on the wall, I in chalk, real faintly, I put the word finish. We finish our work. I mean, mm-hmm. after until we do that, it's all academic. And so in whatever way you can, and if you lose interest, then really that probably means you've made two or three wooden decisions, and you need to press through this kind of substandard time and reach the far shore, and then you can make some decisions and edit, clean it up, and try to get it, you know, working.
Yeah.
But it's, again, that goes back to this hard-headedness. I mean, you got to be stubborn enough to finish your work.
Hmm. So. Now, earlier you said that often your characters don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. You have an event, and that's what is intriguing, and you start writing. So you don't do any sort of outlining, any sort of, you know, I know what the ending is, and I just have to get there?
I don't outline. I've known, in some of my stories, I've known the ending, or I've known the last line, and I've just waited to see if I was patient enough to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit like, I don't know, there's a metaphor I should have right at my hand here, but wait, but you can't force the last line. If you know it, then you work toward it, and you have to wait until it comes round and then finish on it. And so it's, but no, I don't outline stories. With a novel, you need a map, you need an outline, you need whatever planning and sustenance you can give yourself. There's going to be surprises regardless, but I think for my stories, I mean, speaking just for myself and just for this book, I mean, when I think of The Prisoner of Bluestone, I like that story. That started with a sentence, so it had a sentence. There was a camera.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it would go one way, it went another, and then I followed. And it was, once I had this Bluestone building, I was so glad to see it, and then I believed it, then the next thing happened. So that's very much the way I work, and it's kind of an expensive way to work. I mean, you're using up, it takes a lot of attention. You have to believe what you write. You can't question it. You've got to press forward. Most of the stories are like that. They unfold before me, and I try to, when we were talking about endings a minute ago, many times, I can get to a point and I think, oh, I'm two-thirds here, it's about to tip, something, then I can, and if I've got the story all up in my head, every piece of it, juggling it, and I'm conversant with every piece of it, then the ending begins to assemble itself out of the inventory from the first third. I've noticed that. It's so interesting. Wallace Stegner, when he first went to New York, he'd published a novel, they'd sold it, and he went to meet his agent for the first time, and she said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, beside the novel," he said, "I've written some stories," and she said, "Wally, don't write stories. That's burning your principal. All those beginnings and endings, you don't get to use them again." And when I read that about 5 years ago in Stegner's collected stories, and there are not very many stories in that book because he wrote those great novels, I thought, that's right. You don't, these stories, what an odd career choice, because you don't get to use the sets again. You just move on.
Well, you've written novels. You had one come out, Speed of Light.
Yes, I did.
Very recently.
Yes, I did.
What's it like for you? What do you prefer? Are stories more your form, and that's what you tend toward? And what happens when you work on a novel?
Well, it's a long answer, but the shorter answer is this. I'm in love with stories. Okay, I don't care what kind of a career choice it is. I love them. I think I love to read them. I love to read my students' stories. I love to read these anthologies that come for review. The best American stories, just stories. And writing them is a kind of challenge that it's not sensible. I like these stories. I'm a story writer. Novels, I'm writing a novel right now. And what it is, is work. It is work. I'm just typing along here. The pages are piling up. I'm interested in the story. It's got me convinced. I've been working on the book for some time now, 20 months or something, and I probably have many months to go. So I hope that I've kind of let you know what this novel's going to be. It's a nice, sharp, very little, very focused book. But and I've gone without my stories to do it. So that's another, you're speaking to that kind of person too. anyway, so that's where I am on that.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have about 10 minutes left with Ron Carlson, author of A Kind of Flying, with a wonderful cover as well.
You know what happened to that cover?
What?
I just found out. Well, Norton sent me a cover. They've always been so good to me, and they sent me a cover this summer that was just wrong. It was a very comical photograph of two legs in a building, and I talked to Carol Smith, and I said, geez, I can understand why you guys like that, but it's... because not all my stories are comic. This is a range of work.
Yes.
And so they went back to the drawing board. They sent me two photographs. I put them on my mantle, and my family voted, and I kept secret ballot. And then we were unanimous, and we picked this picture that's on the cover now.
Oh, really?
I got an email day before yesterday, and it's the picture is taken by a friend of mine.
Oh, you're kidding.
We used to play softball here. He's a photography professor here. His name is Mark Klett. He's very well known in the West. He did that series of photographs where he went back 100 years after the original photographers and photographed the same places.
Mm-hmm.
So he emailed me and said, hey, thanks for using my picture on your book. And I said, I didn't know. I mean, I just literally, I think yesterday morning, I looked at the credits. So
talk about serendipity.
Yeah, it's sweet. I like
wonderful.
The cover very much.
Hmm. Oh, man. What do we talk about in 10 minutes? Well, one thing I'm curious about, many things, but maybe one that I can narrow in on, is your stories. One thing that's wonderful about them is that there's often not an obvious climax to your story. There's a shape, and then, I mean, there's the beginning, there's the middle, then it goes to a point, and then it drops off, and there's the end. And there's not this major epiphany. There's a very subtle, but sort of... face-slapping epiphany in a way, but no, tapping, maybe tickling.
Okay.
It's just so wonderful, really, and I don't know. I'm curious how you're thinking of your stories, how you're crafting, how you're making sure you're not too subtle, but you're subtle enough, because they just, sometimes stories just hit you over the head with
right.
what it's about, and you don't want to be hit over the head. You want it to be kind of like yours.
Yeah, well, we've seen both, haven't we? We've seen stories that told us too much, and we've seen stories that didn't tell us quite enough, and somewhere in the middle there's a balance. And it's so interesting because of course you don't want to be caught with your big hand steering the story toward the reader's heart, head, or groin, or wherever it's, you're going. But at the same time, I don't think you can think. I don't really think of the reader. What I'm trying to do is to examine the true moment. There's a whole bunch of writing pattern after books, and you see stories that seem booky, where the people act just like people in a story, and they realize things, and they make decisions, and they learn from their mistakes, and all those things that I've been able to go without. And I think that one of the ways, when you put people in situations, they're going to confront them, and I tried to let my people, the characters, confront their these events in human terms and not in character terms. And so I don't know. I know that sometimes it works and sometimes it's a little close. But for example, I mean, this whole idea of the epiphany, which is a kind of, Joyce did it perfectly, and then it was imitated until it became a kind of a cardboard two-dimensional cutout. And so now we have a lot of people realizing things suddenly. And I'm much more interested in how people actually do change course. How does a person stop drinking or go back to his wife or decide to go to school? I mean, where does that happen? I'm so interested in the real examination of that. That's a very hot moment, a very private moment sometimes, but I think a lot of times it takes place, these decisions, in the body. The great epiphany example I use is Jonah and the whale. Because he didn't want to go to Nineveh at all. And I say, how did he go? And the students look at me, and they, no one wants to admit that a fish took him over there, but it comes out. And that that's as good a decision as moments in kind of genre fiction where people suddenly are, they just, it dawns on them. Things dawn on them, or there's where they see a rainbow or hear a bird, and they change their minds. And I'm not doubting that that happens, but it can't happen all the time.
Mm.
So again, I'm speaking about writing closely and then also being able to admit, I'm very interested in having a character confront when he's wrong and either adjust to that weight, try to slide by it, at least the acknowledgement of complicity in the problem. That's very interesting to me. And so I'm dealing, a lot of my stories deal in those kinds of shades of gray.
Hmm. But earlier you said that you're not trying to, when you start writing a story, you're not trying to make a character like you or unlike you, I suppose. I mean, you're just waiting to see who this character is, and if he's like you or not like you, it doesn't much matter. It doesn't sound like you're trying to protect yourself.
No, I'm interested in how he's different from me. I mean, that is to say, how is he, you need a narrator, or in the first person, and I've written a good portion of my stories in the first person, though not all. You're not writing a letter. And so how is the narrator involved? How is he partisan? How is he part of the problem? How is he liable to get in trouble for telling the story? How is he, what is his blind side in terms of the story? And how does some of the story get on him? If he's just an able witness to the event, then your story's going to lack, the story's going to lack a certain dramatic dynamic that's available.
Mm-hmm.
How is the person reluctant to tell the story? An able-bodied, able-minded, fair, even-handed narrator's no use. I don't want to hear that story.
So you're more interested in the first person, writing from the first person?
No, I've done a lot from the first person. I'm writing in the third now a great deal. I mean, I like the third as much. I mean, I like both points of view for their limits. I like the first person for its limits. And we talk a lot about time and the way time limits the first person's ability to know. And there's a larger lesson there. But the third person is just as intimate, just as immediate, maybe more. And it just takes, I had a kind of traditional evolution. I mean, of course, I wrote along in the first person for a while. And these first persons were many times shades of me. And then they migrated and became everybody else. They became women, and they became monsters, and they became... and I was really... I loved that period, and now I'm writing, like I said, now I'm writing a lot in the third person.
Hmm. So. Before I forget, will you talk about what's happening Sunday out this way? You're in L.A.?
Yes, I am. I'm coming to Los Angeles again. There's going to be a reading of some of my stories at Literary Stages in Venice, and they do a thing. I guess it's called brunch, and I think it. So finally, a reading with food. This is all I needed to know.
So
11 to 12 they have brunch, and then from 12 to 2 they're going to be reading. So actors and actresses will be reading some of the stories from these books. And it'll be a treat. That kind of event is just pure gravy.
How can people find out about it?
Well, like I said, it's Literary Stages. I'm looking in my folder right now.
In Venice.
If I have
okay.
That.
And I have the information, so you can email me at writersonwriting.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, good. Good.
.net.
Okay.
I'll tell you. Gosh, Ron, it's great to have you. Any last words, anything we didn't talk about that we should have talked about that I neglected to bring up?
Well, just that, I mean, one of the things on my mind these days is, like, I've been traveling for the last year, and it's interesting, you've got to be careful. I noticed that, I'm speaking to myself now, you got to be careful about, say, giving three readings in a row without having written in between. I mean, that's been hard on me to get back, and all you are is your dirty laundry and your public self, and that's the antithesis of the first, 10 years of my career where I would go 3-4 weeks without leaving my house. And so that balances all of a sudden with these books. I've had a lot of books this year, two books and another paperback, and so I've had to travel with them, and I've met so many interesting people and had talks like this, but your public self is not a particularly good friend to you, to your writing self.
Mm.
So that's all. I'm talking to myself. I need to say it.
Well, it's been a delight as usual, and gosh, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Barbara. I appreciate it so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
All righty.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Ron Carlson speaking to us from Scottsdale, Arizona, and his book again is A Kind of Flying, put out by Norton, and it's just a wonderfully substantial volume of stories that I hope you get a chance to hold in your hands and sit with and read. It's just so many wonderful stories. If you'd like to know more about the event he's participating in on Sunday, email me again at writersonwriting@earthlink.net. And if you want to know more about the show, go to the website, which is writersonwriting.com, and there you can email me as well and ask to be on the weekly email list, and I will put you on it. So every week you'll get a little message that tells you who's coming on the show. And I'll leave you with a quote, as usual, by Margaret Wise Brown, who said, "We speak naturally, but spend all our lives trying to write naturally." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you back here next week.